or the study of beliefs and ideas across the world through time. Cultural history dissects how the past defines the present, everything from art, food, clothing, objects, customs, values, religion. It draws on anthropology and philosophy as well.
Sounds serious.
My mom's a serious lady.
He gave her a rueful smile as he led her past an array of cafes and bars and a quaint-looking sign that said 17th Century Hotel.
They turned down a lane leading to a pocket of residential houses.
Did you tell her we were coming?
It was almost evening and her stomach was grumbling. She didn't know what time zone her body was in anymore. Not exactly. I did leave a message.
So they were just showing up to his mother's without an invitation. That didn't sound good.
All these homes were built in 1850 and have been beautifully restored, Rowan said out of the blue. He motioned to the charming street like a polite realtor.
She couldn't help but wonder if he was getting nervous.
When they arrived at the Victorian townhome, she watched him fish out his own keys from his pocket and unlock the door. He flipped on the lights and stepped aside to let her in. She's probably tied up with a lecture. I'll see what I can cook us up for dinner.
Mellicent's eyebrows shot up. He was going to cook for her?
He hung up their coats and beat a hasty retreat into the kitchen. Seconds later, he called out, Wine?
Yes, please.
Never had a glass sounded more inviting. Here she was, crashing his mom's house without an invitation. Was Rowan going to tell his mother everything that was going on? Were they all going to powwow together over Stuart's laptop? She rubbed her nose, knowing it was surely red from the cold. And she was still standing in the entry hall like an idiot. So much for Rowan's abilities as a host. He'd vanished on her as if he was embarrassed to have brought her there. She hung her muffler on the peg next to her coat and left her boots by the door. When she wandered into the room off the hall, the first things that struck her were the number of books and the musty smell from the dust. The room held a dizzying array of wall-to-wall bookshelves that were filled to capacity with thick volumes and intimidating-looking tomes. Mellicent skimmed the titles closest to her. The Complete Works of Plato, The Histories of Herodotus, The Meaning of Relativity by Albert Einstein, and The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. Merely reading the titles fatigued her. Along with the immense number of books, artifacts in glass cases were scattered about, and a cluttered desk sat in the corner. She had just wandered into Dr. Jocelyn Mathis's study. If an historian could be compared to a mad scientist with a laboratory, this room would definitely fit the bill. Instead of beakers and vials, it was words and relics. There was also something incredibly intimate about the space. There were no pin lights for the glass displays, and the books all looked well-worn and used, like they'd been read too many times. Mellicent turned toward the desk, and a lone photograph on the shelf caught her eye. At first, she thought it was a picture of Rowan, but it was his father. He had glasses on, his black hair was blowing in the wind, and his head was thrown back in laughter. The shot was a close-up, taken on a mountaintop with a ledge of rock and clouds visible on each side of the frame. Mellicent studied his profile. The jawline, the aquiline nose. Everything about him was Rowan. She reached out and picked up the metal frame to study the photo more closely. The moment she held the picture in her hand, she heard the music. The song sounded far off, playing in the distance. Then it began to gain resonance, like a radio in the room, and she recognized it as Unchained Melody by the Righteous Brothers. Oh, my love, my darling, I've hungered for your touch a long, lonely time. Images and thoughts cascaded over the music. They had been woven into the melody. Rowan's parents had gotten married in New Orleans. It had been a boisterous celebration with a wedding parade down Bourbon Street and a second-line brass band. The next day, they had flown to Mexico City for their honeymoon.
Jocelyn had taken the photo of Robert right as the sun was rising on top of Popocatépetl, the most active volcano in Mexico and one of the highest mountains in North America. They'd camped overnight to catch the sunrise. Within the silence at the summit, they could feel the rumbling energy of the earth. There had not been an eruption since 1947, but they thought there might be another in their lifetime. They both agreed Rowan was conceived that night. The imprints within the frame poured into her. Mellicent didn't know how long she stood there until she turned to find Rowan standing in the doorway with two wine glasses in hand. Embarrassment flooded her cheeks, and she put the picture frame back down. "Your father's picture," she said, stating the obvious and realizing she had just witnessed some very personal memories.
"Yes."
He came toward her to offer her the wine. She murmured her thanks and turned back toward the picture, still unbalanced from the deluge of information it had imparted. "Have you touched this?" Rowan stared at the picture of his father and shook his head.
"I don't touch my parents' things. It'd be infringing."
He hadn't meant to say it as a reprimand, but still she could feel a fresh flush on her face. She had infringed. It hadn't been intentional, but she had seen private moments. Every anniversary, Jocelyn would play Unchained Melody to hear her wedding song. It's why the photo was so full of the music. Mellicent could feel the lingering emotions from the imprint squeezing her throat, taking away any words she might have said. Instead, she took a sip of the wine. After reading the imprints, it felt like the lines of Jocelyn's life and her own had momentarily blurred, and the wedding song was an echo in the room that would never fade. Rowan had a closed look on his face.
"They were complicated. They divorced when I was 13.
It was obvious he didn't like talking about it.
"Some people aren't meant to be together, even if they want to be. Life gets in the way."
Mellicent looked up at him and realized he wasn't just talking about his parents. She set her wine down and took a step toward him. "I disagree." His eyes darkened.
"Mellicent,"
he said in warning. Ignoring the caution in his voice, she took the final step and kissed him, their mouths twisting in the dance that had begun on the plane and never stopped. His gloved fingers slipped around her waist and traveled up her back. It was the sound of the front door opening that broke them apart. Jocelyn Mathis stood in the foyer looking exactly as Mellicent had imagined her, only now her hair was silver and her glasses were bigger. In her college years, Jocelyn had been a philosophy major, a cutting-edge feminist, a wild child of the 60s and 70s, and then a wife in the 80s. When she had gotten married, she'd had cat-eye glasses and black hair, cut spiky short like Annie Lennox. Jocelyn's sharp gaze took in the two of them, the wine glasses, the picture frame of her late ex-husband set ever so slightly off from where she had placed it last, and the stamp of the kiss on their faces.
"Why, hello." She raised both eyebrows and set down her briefcase. She shrugged off her coat. "When I asked you to come to dinner, Rowan, I had hoped for advance notice."
Jocelyn said it so cordially, Mellicent couldn't tell if she was upset or not.
I left you a message," Rowan said. "Well, I lost my phone, so I didn't get it."
Jocelyn came forward, her hand already extended to shake Mellicent's.
"And you are?"
Rowan spoke up first.
"This is Mellicent Tilpin from Los Angeles." "It's a pleasure to meet you, Mellicent. And I bet you two were at Paddington Station."
Jocelyn didn't wait for confirmation and marched straight into the den and turned on the TV.
"I'm sure they're airing it on a loop. It's the feel-good story of the day. Lord knows we all need one."
Rowan and Mellicent followed her into the den to catch the news story already underway. A female reporter stood beside the Paddington Bear statue.
"Is Sirius Black alive and well? A little girl from York seems to believe.
Today, 5-year-old Anna Montgomery was lost in Paddington Station, where she said a man in all black from Hogwarts cast a spell to find out her mother's phone number and wrote it down on a piece of paper, allowing Anna to be reunited with her family. Anna's parents could not be more grateful to the mysterious stranger. Perhaps there is magic somewhere in the world. Millicent watched the TV in fascination. They had made the news. She looked at Rowan, and he gave her a little smile.
"So I take it that was you?" Jocelyn asked in exasperation, although she already knew the answer. "Rowan, you shouldn't take risks like that. What if you had been identified? How could you have explained it?"
"No one saw me."
Rowan brushed off her concern. He took out his cell phone and opened up a tracking app.
"And it says your phone is somewhere here in the house."
"Of course it is."
She rolled her eyes. Rowan tried calling it. She shook her head.
"I'm sure the battery's dead. I'll never find it."
Rowan smiled.
"Always the pessimist."
"Realist. Now tell me exactly what's going on. You can explain everything while you're cooking. And please, put on some house slippers. The floors are chilly."
Jocelyn sounded like a general ordering them about. She brought 2 pairs of guest slippers from the entry hall closet and returned to her study to reset the photograph where it had been before.
"Welcome to my home, Millicent.
I'm sorry I wasn't here to greet you personally."
Millicent watched Jocelyn through the doorway and couldn't help but detect the censure in Jocelyn's voice that silently conveyed, "Don't touch my things." Rowan's mother knew he wouldn't dare touch the photograph. A blush rose in Millicent's cheeks. If Millicent hadn't held the photo beforehand, she would have been intimidated by the woman. But all she could think about was how incredibly lonely Jocelyn was underneath her brisk demeanor.
"So, tell me what on earth is going on. Start at the beginning."
Jocelyn turned off the lights in her study, leaving Robert West's portrait to sit in the shadows, with eyes that seemed to continue to see.
24. The map. Rowan ate without tasting a thing. At this point, he barely remembered cooking the pasta. He tried to focus on the conversation at the dinner table as he brought his mother up to speed about Stuart, their failed meeting in El Paso, and the mysterious Upart delivery. He underplayed everything, not revealing Stuart's abduction or Millicent's involvement. That would take all evening and require another bottle of wine between them. He could tell his mother had questions for him, too, about Millicent, the first person he'd brought to her doorstep. When they were out of this mess, he could figure out what to do about his growing feelings for her. He didn't have to touch Millicent's wine glass to know that she was equally affected. When they were done eating, Jocelyn turned on the TV to catch the evening news, and Rowan turned to Stuart's laptop, booting it up. Fortunately, he didn't need a password to log on. Stuart had been careless, but then he'd also thought his computer would stay locked up in his safe. The three of them sitting at the dinner table with the TV on and Rowan at the computer looked strangely domestic. Rowan couldn't begin to guess what Millicent was thinking. The trip must have taken a surreal turn for her. Here they were in Oxford, having a spaghetti dinner with his mother in a dusty, cluttered Victorian house, while a stiff upper lip British news anchor went on about world events. Millicent probably thought Jocelyn rude for preferring the BBC over visiting with her. Then again, maybe after reading the imprints from the picture frame, Millicent understood that his mother didn't do small talk. He also should have warned her that Jocelyn was addicted to the news, specifically the BBC or CNN. The TV was always on. One of the top stories tonight was about 36 whales that had been stranded on Tysfjord's beaches in northern Norway. A female reporter was commenting, "Whale watching season may have ended for the rest of Europe, but orcas abound in Tysfjord every winter through December, when the whales follow schools of herring into the fjords. However, this year something has gone amiss. The whales are ending up on the shores, scientists say, due to geomagnetic disruptions from solar storms." Rowan and Millicent both watched the report, and Rowan couldn't help but think the Uparts could be categorized as a geomagnetic disruption, too. They were just harder to find than a whale on a beach. Rowan turned back to the laptop and scrolled through Stuart's files. It would take time to go through them all. Jocelyn was eyeing him.
So what exactly was Stuart working on with these out-of-place artifacts?
Rowan looked up from skimming the most recent project file. From what I can tell, he's been tracking every Upart ever discovered, recording the time and place they originally existed in, and when and where the objects were rediscovered. It's as if they're jumping through time. Jocelyn gave Rowan a stern look.
How is that possible, jumping through time?
She peered at him over the rim of her glasses, looking every bit the discerning professor.
What are they? What are Uparts?
She even lowered the TV volume to hear the answer. Rowan hesitated. He'd been studying the mechanics of time all his life, but when it came to Uparts, he didn't have a clear picture of the phenomenon yet. The subject was like the Bermuda Triangle of the archaeological world. Like crop circles, Uparts were either brushed off as a hoax, explained away, or ignored. But Stuart had dedicated the past several years to solving the riddle, and it had begun for him with Descartes' ring. So how was a ring from a man born in France in the late 1500s found in Jordan buried in Cretaceous rock? He glanced between the two women. Mellicent was waiting for his answer too, and he attempted to explain. Our physical reality is made up of 99.9% space. Our bodies and everything around us are, in essence, the leftover 0.1%, organized within a vast sea of energy. These out-of-place artifacts are jumping in and out of the electromagnetic boundary between our 0.1% and that space. If the Uparts on Stuart's list are legitimate anomalies, then the question becomes, have they been jumping into new locations and timelines with intention? Or is it random? Jocelyn nodded, pensive. Through Rowan's ability, she and her son had learned a long time ago that the impossible was possible. He went on. These Uparts could even be the result of a time-traveling experiment in the future. Right now, we don't know, which seems to be the question Stuart is trying to answer. Rowan glanced back to the computer, toggling between files. Stuart had been unable to correlate all the Uparts' timelines together to find any pattern.
And you say he's unreachable now? Jocelyn asked.
Rowan nodded, a knot in his stomach. He couldn't bring himself to tell her Stuart had been captured by the men who wanted his research. Jocelyn was the one who'd introduced Stuart to Rowan in the first place. He was a family friend. Jocelyn had met the unorthodox archaeologist, a pioneer who paired psychometry with archaeology, and invited him to do several guest lectures for her students at Oxford. After Stuart's first lecture, she'd called Rowan, insisting he had to meet him. Rowan had been surprised by the suggestion, knowing her and her father's opinion of allowing anyone to know about his abilities. It was the one thing the estranged couple had always agreed upon. Only Holly knew about his gift. His parents had kept Rowan sheltered for most of his life. Rowan flew out to Oxford and sat in on a lecture to hear what Stuart Albee had to say. The outspoken Brit used his psychometric ability to survey archaeological sites, attempting to assess what had existed in the past at a location and what may be buried there. His success rate was good enough that he had earned a name in the field and worked with clients across the globe. He called what he did intuitive archaeology. Rowan watched him explain with glee to a hall of rapt Oxford history students how reading bones was his specialty. He held up a femur to the class with a dramatic pause.
I can pick up a bone and gather the general facts of a person's life. I may not always get it right, but I get it right enough times to count. Because bones, Stuart said, can tell you anything.
Rowan listened, amazed that he had not only found another psychometrist, but a psychometrist who enjoyed the notoriety of being one.
Using intuitives at digs, Stuart said, pointing to himself, is a fringe idea and usually scoffed at by academia. The word psychic is even more taboo. And yet here I am at Oxford talking to you chaps, so I can't be too batty.
The lecture hall broke into laughter.
Only one renowned archaeologist in Canada, Dr. Norman Emerson from the University of Toronto, has ever officially shared his findings while working with a psychometrist on his digs. That was with George McMullen. Emerson and McMullen worked closely together for decades, until Dr. Emerson passed away in the late 70s, but they had many successes. He gave them an engaging smile. I have found Byzantine ruins, lost mosaics, buried columns, hidden statues, and even a stone labyrinth, all with the power of my hands and my mind. He held up his hands to make his point. Now, I love all the gadgets and technology just as much as the next archaeologist. I work with magnetometers, aerial thermal imaging. I rely on light detection, geophysics, and X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy. But there's something I can do that ground-penetrating radar simply can't, and that is to sense the ghost ship of the past that is sailing all around us. He opened his arms wide. So, don't be afraid to hop aboard. The lecture ended to roaring applause. Rowan introduced himself after the last student left. The instant camaraderie and connection between them was the start of a friendship that cemented quickly.
My God, I hope he's all right.
Jocelyn's eyes were bright. She got up to clear away the dishes. Mellicent jumped up to help, but Jocelyn brushed aside her attempt. Mellicent abandoned her place at the table to study the laptop too, and pulled up a chair right next to Rowan, making a loud noise in the process. She pointedly ignored Rowan's questioning look and leaned in to study the screen. Rowan could feel his mother's eyes on them. Jocelyn was wondering how in the world Mellicent factored into all of this, a question he didn't want to answer. He got up and opened the poster tube Stuart had hidden with his computer. Inside, he found a map of the world with specific sites on every continent, marked with bright yellow X's. He unrolled it on the far side of the dining table. Mellicent and Jocelyn joined him to look at it.
So these X's are all the Uparts he's sure about? Mellicent asked.
There were over 36 X's circling the globe. He noticed the frown on Mellicent's face. What is it?
I don't know.
She blinked several times and rubbed her eyes to clear her vision. Jocelyn noticed.
You must be tired. Why don't you both look at this with fresh eyes in the morning? How long will you be staying?
She asked him, appearing hopeful. Just tonight, Rowan answered. I've arranged for us to fly back to the States in the afternoon.
And is it one or two bedrooms? She tried to ask with nonchalance.
Only Rowan could tell his mother was struggling to sound casual. Then he watched with fascination as Mellicent's face bloomed a solid pink. Between her and his mother acting like Mary Poppins, it made him want to laugh. Two, please.
Of course. Let me make up the beds. I'll help.
Mellicent hurried to follow her. He watched the two head up the stairs. Mellicent was saying,
You have a lovely home. I wouldn't say lovely. I haven't dusted in years.
Rowan shook his head to himself as they disappeared. Poor Mellicent. Not many people tried to strike up conversation with the prickly professor. Jocelyn had bought the house 10 years ago when she first moved to Oxford, intending to stay in England for good. When she crossed the ocean, Jocelyn left her previous life in New Orleans behind. Rowan was always the one who had to travel to see her, and she preferred not to know if her son was still using his abilities. She'd made her stance on that clear after Turkey. She believed that Rowan's gift would one day kill him. His mother might not approve if she discovered Mellicent was like him. Even worse, Mellicent had peered into the private recesses of her life. He'd stood riveted in the doorway, watching the expressions on Mellicent's face as she experienced the imprints within the picture frame. He would have loved to ask her what she'd seen, but that wouldn't be fair to his mother. Mellicent had overstepped by touching that photograph, but she hadn't thought about the consequences. That kind of understanding and foresight could only come with time and experience. Creating boundaries was something she would have to learn. Rowan sighed and went back to studying the computer and the map, trying to understand what it was that Stuart had discovered. And he couldn't ignore the feeling festering inside him that if only he'd helped when Stuart asked him years ago in Colorado, then his friend wouldn't be missing now.
Stuart had shared his findings with the wrong person. Rowan was anxious to hear back from Sun. He also needed to find out more about Gian. Gian might be the key to all of this. He looked back at the list of files still left to go through. A file named Circles made him sit up straighter with an edge of excitement. He'd just found Miguel and Stuart's research on crop circles.
25. The Book.
Are these your books?
Millicent recognized the titles of Jocelyn's work on the guest bedroom bookshelf. Jocelyn had authored two theoretical history books, Chasing History and The History of Time. A dozen copies of each were perched on the shelf.
Those would be mine, Jocelyn said dryly, busy making up the spare bed.
May I? Millicent asked.
Of course.
Jocelyn gave her a tight smile and went to the door.
There's fresh towels in the bathroom and bottled water downstairs. Please help yourself.
Good night.
That was the extent of the conversation. Jocelyn was not in the mood to visit. All Rowan's mother probably wanted to know was how Millicent knew her son, and if they were sleeping together. At this point, Millicent was too tired to worry about what Jocelyn thought of her. She was too tired to even shower. She could do that in the morning. Instead, she brushed her teeth and changed into her pajamas. In New Orleans, she had bought long underwear and a long-sleeved shirt to match, the kind that could be worn under ski gear. Thermals had seemed the best bet for England in December, and she was glad she'd gotten them. The house had a frosty nip to it, just like the professor. She crawled into bed with one of Jocelyn's books, and for a moment simply enjoyed the luxury of the feather comforter. Then she reached over for her purse on the nightstand and grabbed her cell phone to call her brother. He answered on the first ring.
Hey, you okay?
That's funny. She smiled. I was calling to ask you the same thing.
How's London? Did you find anything?
Some. I'll fill you in when we're back. We should be there by tomorrow night. You staying put at the hotel? She asked, unsure whether he would think her return was a good thing. The truth was that ever since she had discovered her brother had been planning to run away, she didn't know what to say to him. For a moment, neither said anything.
Mel, I'm sorry.
She expelled a breath, feeling tears coming on. There. He had finally opened a door to discuss it. Of course he'd waited until she was thousands of miles away.
For what?
Planning to leave me?
Her voice broke.
It wasn't like that, he pleaded. I didn't want to be a burden to you, for you to have to take care of me.
Was I complaining?
You didn't have to. I knew you didn't want to come back home. I know how much you were struggling. Then Mom died and we were going to lose the house.
Were you ever going to get in touch? Let me know you were safe.
I hadn't thought that far ahead.
His voice wobbled, and he broke down.
I just miss her so much.
Warm tears slipped from her eyes. I miss her too, Park, she whispered.
I'm sorry, he said.
I love you.
We're going to stick together.
Nothing more needed to be said. When she returned, they could begin to rebuild their lives. After they hung up, Millicent closed her eyes, suddenly feeling alone and far away, like a planet out of orbit hurtling through space. She wanted to go back with Parker and be in their mother's home. She wanted to make snow globes and run Tish's shop, even though on some days it drove her crazy. But none of that was possible anymore. The fingerprint of her life no longer matched what it used to be. Parker was all she had left, and Rowan had unknowingly helped tear down the invisible wall that had stood between them, which she hadn't known existed. In the months before and after her mother's funeral, Millicent had sought out her mother's things and touched them for comfort, worn Sadie's favorite sweater, handled all her treasured knickknacks sitting out on the countertops and tables. But Millicent had never once thought to touch Parker's things, to sense how he was on the inside. Rowan had held her brother's wristband and learned more about him than she had in years. What if she had thought to reach out sooner, to connect with him on a deeper level, to look past the surface? Maybe Parker wouldn't have felt like he was such a burden. Rowan knew how to look beyond the facades people wore to get to the inner truth. He'd seen past her facade on that first day when he walked into the shop. He'd seen her, and he knew her. She replayed their last kiss in the study, wondering what he thought, how he felt. She wished she knew. And why hadn't he mentioned her involvement in this whole situation to his mother? Or that she was a psychometrist, too. Millicent was following his lead by staying mute on those details. But doing so stung. Jocelyn must be assuming she was some starry-eyed groupie. The whole idea put her in a foul mood. With a sigh, she opened up Jocelyn's book, Chasing History, to see what Rowan's mother had to say about the subject, since her son had been doing it his whole life. The first chapter, The Future of History, began with Jocelyn making the claim that the seat of recorded history would transfer to the realm of neuroscience, genetics, and physics. Current recorded history was selective and subjective, the argument without end. But it was objects that held the objective past, with no judgment, no bias, no editing, no censure. The past was a pure, simple recording, and she believed future historians, futurians as she called them, would one day be able to decipher history much better. Talk about facades. Jocelyn Mathis had perhaps the biggest facade of them all. One of the most respected historians in the world had a son who could rectify any historical discrepancy, and yet she could never come forward with the findings because she couldn't explain her source testimony was alive and well. Dr. Mathis's tour de force through the past wasn't a scholar's quest for knowledge, but the result of a mother trying to help her son. Her book delved into history's discrepancies to show how historical narrative oftentimes went astray. There were the easy examples, how Napoleon wasn't short but of standard height, and Marie Antoinette did not infamously say, "Let them eat cake." Another queen did, 100 years before her. Jocelyn also took great care in pointing out historical ghosts, not ghosts in the literal sense, but within written records. Ghosts were the opinions of scholars that had been passed down but were never challenged. The danger was that a ghost could become accepted as a commonplace fact. Jocelyn wanted to expose as many historical ghosts as possible because she believed, when someone realizes the foundation of the floor beneath their feet has cracks, they will look closer at the ground they are walking on. The more Millicent read, the more she couldn't help but feel every word on the page was the result of a struggle to reconcile the mechanics of time within the human experience. Jocelyn had been trying to keep up with Rowan by researching what he was holding and where he was going with his mind. Along the way, she'd begun to see history's flaws in a glaring light, how fragile and subjective it was, how the past was shaped by the beliefs of the present and then used to form the beliefs of the future. Even Herodotus, the father of history, was the first to admit he was only recording what he had been told. Jocelyn had become an historian's historian by default, not by choice. Robert West believed Rowan had been born for a higher purpose, and that his ability needed to be nurtured. All Jocelyn saw was her little boy struggling, unable to shoulder the past, like Atlas holding the weight of the world. With that thought, an image popped into Millicent's mind. Atlas. She sat up, realizing what it was about Stuart's map that had been bothering her. She got out of bed and hurried downstairs. By the quiet of the house and the silence of the TV, she could tell that Jocelyn had gone to sleep. She found Rowan still sitting at the dining table with Stuart's laptop. He looked up when she entered, and his eyes traveled over her leggings and nightshirt.
She took a step forward, feeling self-conscious in her silk winter thermals. Rowan had surely seen sexier pajamas than this. He closed out the file of whatever he had been looking at on the computer.
"Couldn't sleep?"
he asked, keeping his voice quiet. "No, I thought of something," she said in a hushed voice. "It's about the map." Earlier, when she had seen Stuart's map, the X's had drawn her attention, but they'd seemed off, like a painting that was warped. Her artist's eye could see those X's formed a shape. Would it be possible to recreate the markings on the map, but put it into 3D, so it's on a globe? Understanding dawned in Rowan's eyes, and he turned back to the computer. Within minutes, he had transferred Stuart's U-part coordinates onto a virtual globe of the world. They didn't even have to rotate it to see the partial geometric patterns taking shape. But that was where the progress stopped, with a broken net of lines and partial figures. Mellicent's shoulders fell in disappointment. That hadn't been helpful. Rowan was frowning at the map, lost in thought. She offered, "Well, it was worth a try. Good night." She hesitated and waited for him to look up, to see that right now she wanted to reach out to him. When he did look at her, she could see the distance in his eyes. His mind was somewhere else entirely. She couldn't help but take it as a rejection. An invisible barrier stood between them again. He was caught up in Stuart's research. Now was not the right time. She would not be initiating another kiss. She was also done with facades, including her own. So she told him, point blank, "The next time we kiss, I want your gloves off. Period." Without waiting for a response, she went back up the stairs, letting his soft, "Good night," fall behind her back.
26. The File. After Mellicent's surprise announcement and exit up the stairs, Rowan had trouble returning to Stuart's research. Before she'd come downstairs, he'd been reading the file on crop circles, and the map he and Mellicent tried to create tonight had been a step in the right direction. He was on the brink of a discovery. He could feel it. He forced his attention back to Stuart's notes. "Makers of crop circles are masters of geometry. There are never any errors in their work, either in form or measurement. There are no footprints left behind, no broken stalks. And when the crop circle appears in a field of flowers, the flowers are never crushed, but perfectly preserved. The precision within the technique is surgical. Even more perplexing, the designs have grown in complexity over the years, comprising intricate spirals, fractals, and knots with interlocking triangles, pentagons, hexagons, dodecagons, and other geometric shapes. The labyrinth is an important design element as well. The circles have a tendency to create a maze-like pattern within the design." Rowan studied the aerial photography imported into the file. He could make out a labyrinth in many of the designs, but Rowan knew there was a marked difference between a labyrinth and a maze. A labyrinth had only one path to take, and there were no false ends to become lost in like a maze. In cultures around the world, labyrinths were considered to be the enchanted path the mind walked in order to arrive at the answer at the center. Throughout the centuries, and no matter which religion, walking the labyrinth was considered a path of meditation. These circles were laying down labyrinths. Stuart's notes accompanied the images. "Over 10,000 crop circles have appeared to date in almost every country, with the majority unclaimed, conjured by a group of silent artists. The circles' designs have not once, ever, repeated themselves. The circles, like U-parts, are found near many ancient sacred sites. They also form near water. Scientists believe that the ground near aquifers holds a greater electrical charge. Crop circles leave a magnetic charge in the soil where they appear. Using a microscope, biologists have discovered tiny micron sphere-shaped particles of iron attached to the stalks.
These microscopic magnets seem to be remnants of some kind of energy source. The oopaths, when measured with the same instruments, show an altered magnetic field, too.
Stewart had underlined that last part. Rowan frowned. He'd never touched the grass within a crop circle, but he could attest that Uparts felt magnetically charged. Stewart had drawn a correlation. The partial shapes the map formed in 3D hinted that the Uparts formed a larger geometric design, but it wasn't complete. Rowan couldn't help but think he was overlooking something. Knowing sleep was out of the question, he made himself a cup of Earl Grey and drew the curtains in the dining room. He wasn't used to being in rooms with windows, and he found them disconcerting. The feeling he was being watched kept circling around him, and he tried to brush the sensation off. It didn't help that there were no flowers outside due to the cold. After closing the blinds and setting the house alarm, he sat back down at the table with his tea to study Stewart's map. There had to be an answer here he wasn't seeing. He'd never been so confounded by an artifact before. And now there was an entire collection of them spread across the globe. He went back to the crop circle photos and enlarged the picture of a labyrinth circle found near Celle, France, in June 2014. The longer he gazed at it, the more the image began to remind him of tree rings within a trunk. The labyrinth had two openings on the outer edge. As Rowan's eyes traveled the path to its center, he thought, too, how Uparts existed in two time periods. In essence, they existed in two places. Rowan stopped, gripped by an idea. Two places. When his eyes landed on the labyrinth center, he found the answer. He went back to Stewart's spreadsheet and entered in a new set of coordinates for each Upart onto the 3D global map. So far, they'd plugged in the coordinates where the Uparts were last found, not where they originally came from. The objects, in essence, existed twice and at two locations. That meant two points on the map, not one. Only a psychometrist would have been able to find that original coordinate. Together, Stewart and Miguel had pinpointed each Upart's city and country of origin. Excitement rose within Rowan, and a feeling of momentum took over as he entered the new data points. Goosebumps trailed over his arms and up his neck when he watched the geometric shapes complete themselves on the map. The labyrinth had just unlocked the secret. The connecting lines between all the Uparts with their twin sets of data points transformed the map of the world into a dazzling array of geometric perfection. All the lines crisscrossed and intersected each other to form intricate shapes within shapes in an arrangement of circles, triangles, diamonds, and star-like pentagons. It was like looking at the inside of a kaleidoscope. "My God," he whispered. Rowan couldn't begin to process what he was seeing. These seemingly random Uparts actually had perfect symmetry and coherency between them as they jumped through time. The Uparts, like the crop circles, were a mathematical equation. Rowan couldn't help but see the connection. One of the Uparts was a ring that belonged to the man who had married geometry and algebra and created a coordinate system to locate any object in space, including on a map. René Descartes. René Descartes also believed geometry was the language of the universe. Rowan stared at the computer screen with wonder. The image formed by the Uparts' coordinates looked like one giant crop circle imprinted on the earth.
27. The Song. Millicent woke up early and stayed in bed, snuggling under the down comforter to read the chapter in Jocelyn's book on ancient silk weavers. In Japan, ancient weavers believed 1,000 stories could exist in a single thread. Threads were woven together and sometimes broke, but they always remained. In that way, too, so did the past remain forever a part of the tapestry of life. Jocelyn's words somehow brought comfort to her. Even though her possessions and the physical links to her past were gone, her memories would always be a part of her. They were the threads of her life. Millicent held the book to her chest and closed her eyes, feeling her first goodbye to the house she grew up in, riding on the exhale of her breath. She brought the book with her downstairs after she had showered and changed into jeans and a cable-knit sweater. She found Rowan and Jocelyn at the table, watching news from the States on CNN. Jocelyn stood up with a brisk,
"Good morning. Coffee and toast?" She was already heading to the kitchen to get it.
"Please." Millicent sat down at the table. Rowan looked preoccupied and asked in an absent tone,
"Did you sleep well?"
"Very." In fact, she couldn't remember the last time she had slept so soundly. Jocelyn returned with coffee and a thick piece of brioche bread with butter and set out jams and marmalade. Millicent signaled to the book on the table. "Are you sure it's okay if I take it with me?"
"Of course."
Jocelyn was flattered, but still dubious.
"Are you sure you want to read it? It might be a bit hard to get through."
Rowan snorted at that, and his mother playfully whacked his arm. Jocelyn informed her,
"He has yet to read one of my books."
Millicent's mouth dropped open. She looked at Rowan. "You've never read her work?" Jocelyn didn't look the least bit bothered.
"I'm afraid it would only frustrate him."
Rowan smiled.
"My mother is long-winded."
Jocelyn laughed out loud at that. It made her look years younger, and Millicent caught a glimpse of Jocelyn from years before. Reading the book seemed to be an ongoing joke between them. Jocelyn turned to Millicent.
"You don't have to either. I have thick skin."
"No, I'd like to. I'm beginning to have a deeper appreciation for history." Millicent left it at that. Jocelyn gave Millicent a prim look, obviously thinking her newfound appreciation for history was because of Rowan. Maybe Rowan was to thank. If he had never come to Los Angeles, Millicent wouldn't know anyone who shared her ability, much less what that ability looked like if it were nurtured over time. She sneaked a peek at him from under her lashes as she ate. He was watching the TV, looking troubled by the news. The reporter was saying,
"Tonight in New York City, we're outside a residential building across the street from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where a fire broke out hours ago on the 15th floor.
Jocelyn put a hand to her mouth.
"My word."
The footage showed the corner windows on the building's 15th floor engulfed in flames. The blaze shot up like a pinnacle to the midnight sky. London was 5 hours ahead of New York, so it was still the middle of the night in the States. The street had erupted in pandemonium, with firefighters on the scene and police cordoning off the area. The reporter said,
"As you can see, firefighters are hard at work containing the flames. We've received no word yet if there are any victims."
Millicent's stomach turned. All the memories of her mother's home came flooding back, along with the sheer terror and panic of that night. For a moment, she thought she might be sick. After the news report ended, Rowan became even more quiet. By the time they were gathering their things to head back to London to catch their flight, he had retreated so much into his head, he barely said goodbye to his mother. Jocelyn wrung her hands together with worry.
"Are you sure you're going to be all right? There's nothing more I can do to help."
She must have sensed that there was a lot Rowan wasn't telling her. Millicent was beginning to feel the same way. Rowan shook his head with a distracted air.
"I'll be fine. I'll call you soon,"
he promised, and reminded her,
"Get a new phone."
Jocelyn saluted him with a smile, unable to hide the fact that she was bereft he was leaving.
"Check in with me tomorrow, please. I want to know the minute you hear from Stuart."
Millicent came forward and gave her a big hug, surprising all three of them with her warmth. But Jocelyn needed a hug, a proper hug, the kind that made her feel better for having gotten it. Jocelyn stiffened in response like a cat, then she relaxed and returned the gesture.
"It was lovely to meet you."
She had a softer look in her eyes. "You too, Dr. Mathis," Millicent said. but Rowan's mother insisted she call her Jocelyn. Mellicent nodded and patted her purse. Thanks for the book. Now she and Rowan were on the plane, well over the Atlantic, and Mellicent was reading while Rowan ignored her. He'd barely said two words since they'd taken off. They might as well have been on separate flights. The plane sat 12. Two rows of 6 seats on each side of the aisle faced one another, like 2 long sofas. Rowan was sitting across from her, several seats down, as though they were total strangers. The flight was 10 hours. 10 torturous hours. They had taken off at 2 p.m. and were arriving at 6 p.m., though it'd feel like midnight when they landed. Doing the math made Mellicent's head hurt. She wasn't sure if she was still jet-lagged, or about to be. When Rowan stood up to stretch, he surprised her by joking,
"Maybe if you keep reading, the book will perk up."
Mellicent cocked an eyebrow at him. "So you're talking now?" He sighed in regret, sounding like he meant it.
"Yes, of course. I'm sorry. I have a lot on my mind."
He sat down next to her but didn't say anything for a long moment. He stared at the floor. Then he said,
"I didn't want to say anything in front of my mom. But the fire that happened in Manhattan on the news, I know who lives there."
He turned to look at her.
"It's a psychometrist in Stewart's group."
Mellicent's heart dropped.
"She's the person I called to warn. I've been to her place before."
"Oh my God." Tears welled in Mellicent's eyes, and she blinked them back. These people, whoever they were, had come after this woman too. Rowan ran his fingers through his hair in agitation.
"I want you to stay with me at my place, you and Parker. I'll have Holly bring him from the hotel in the morning. It's the safest place for you right now."
His words wrapped around her like a warm embrace. She nodded in acceptance.
"Good,"
he said, relieved.
"We'll get through this," he vowed solemnly.
They stared into each other's eyes. A bundle of emotions were swimming inside her. Then he surprised her by tugging off his glove and brushing the hair away from her face in a tender caress.
"About that special request you made last night?"
He took off his other glove, and his hands framed her face. His kiss was tender and full of promise. She pulled away, their lips still hovering near each other. She asked him the question that had been on her mind. "Why didn't you tell your mother I'm a psychometrist?"
"Because I wanted her to like you,"
he admitted with a smile.
"She doesn't approve of me using my ability."
Mellicent made a silent, "Oh." She hadn't considered that Rowan cared what Jocelyn thought of her. The thought pleased her, and she held on to it. She'd take as much normalcy as she could get right now. Rowan slipped his gloves back on and stood up.
"After you went to sleep last night, I made an incredible discovery."
He brought over Stewart's laptop.
"I plugged in a new set of coordinates where the U-parts originated from and came up with this."
When he showed her the computer screen with the new version of the map, Mellicent gasped. It was the most beautiful creation she had ever seen, an exquisite work of art. "The U-parts made this?" She could barely speak. What in the world were they looking at?
"Your idea last night led me to it."
Rowan was just as riveted.
"It's like a mathematical key."
"Unbelievable," she whispered. The map looked like a beautiful mandala.
"The group's theory was correct. The U-parts aren't random."
"Then what are they?" She looked to him. "How did they make this?" Rowan shook his head.
"I don't know."
She could tell he was determined to find out. They looked at the map for a long time in silence, marveling at its perfection, and awe filled her. She couldn't begin to process this discovery. Where did they go from here? "Can I touch the U-part you have?" She felt like she could handle the key. When he'd shown it to her at the airport, she'd been too shell-shocked by the fire to want to touch it. Hesitation crossed his face.
You don't want to. Trust me. There's a memory that'd be hard to see.
Mellicent swallowed her disappointment, but nodded, letting go of her request. After what happened in New Orleans, she wasn't ready to experience such despair again. Rowan closed the laptop and put it aside.
Why don't we study this more later? I was up all night with it.
He went to the galley, poured them each a glass of white wine in an elegant stemless glass, and brought over a charcuterie board that had been prepared with assorted cheeses, baguette slices, fig jam, and Marcona almonds. She took a sip of the crisp Sauvignon Blanc and selected a piece of aged Gouda to nibble on while her thoughts returned to the key. I do want to read the key's imprints at some point, she told him. She couldn't be afraid of finding negative memories forever. How do you get past the bad imprints to find the others? She had seen his notes for the Lakota collection, how he was able to unravel multiple imprints in an object from various times. She didn't understand how he did it. He considered her question before answering,
It's like layers in an ocean. You have to swim through each memory with your intention. Your mind becomes fluid, moving around the moments. You decide how fast you swim, how far, in what direction, and when to stay. Take the wine glass you're holding.
He nodded to the glass in her hand.
There are countless imprints embedded there. Try and focus until you can see the last three people who held the glass before you.
Mellicent looked at the glass in her hand with surprise.
Do a mudra to prepare, whatever one feels the most empowering. Deepen your breath. And remember, you are in control as you encounter the memories. Sometimes it can be hard to push past a negative one. It just takes focus.
Is that how you find people for the Heirloom Foundation? Through the water method? He chuckled.
Yes, something like that.
He took her hand and kissed it. She was coming to love when he did. Rowan leaned back, closing his eyes.
I need to take a nap, if that's all right.
Mellicent could tell he was exhausted. She watched him fall asleep, and the guarded look on his face slowly melted away. She studied his gloves, which were back on his hands, and wondered when he started wearing them and at what age. He was so experienced at reading imprints, and he'd already taught her so much. She mentally sifted through the small collection of mudras that she'd learned, and settled on the first one Roan had shown her, the Shakti Mudra. She went to put down her wine, almost knocking the glass, but then caught it before it spilled and grimaced. Her clumsiness was the result of being out of step with herself. Maybe she had been out of step for a long time. Her mother used to tell her that cynicism was born from a fearful heart. And, looking back, Mellicent had not wanted to acknowledge her extraordinary ability. She'd stifled her gift. It had taken her mother getting sick to wake her up, to force her to embrace her inner power and re-examine who she was. Now, she was living in a world where not only was the past touchable, but it was trying to communicate through these strange artifacts. She could either run from this new world or embrace her ability and try to understand it. That started one imprint at a time. Expelling a deep breath, she settled her hands into the mudra and closed her eyes. When she was ready, she picked up her wine glass and tried to read its history. The first imprint came quickly. A lead singer from a band she didn't know was on tour in Europe, and the man had last used the glass to hold his red wine. He spent most of the flight composing a song for his next album with his acoustic guitar. As much as Mellicent tried, she couldn't get past the singer's imprint to anyone else's. After several attempts, she felt the start of a headache and gave up. Rowan made it sound so much easier than it actually was. She finished off her wine in a salute to the artist and made a mental note to buy the band's latest album when she was back in the States. The song was quite good. She closed her eyes, softly humming its tune. She must have dozed off, because when she opened her eyes, her ears were popping as the plane made its descent. Outside the plane window, the lights of New Orleans were glittering jewels, and the cityscape crested against the Mississippi like a moon. Its nickname, the Crescent City, had never seemed more appropriate. When the plane touched down, the account manager of the charter company overseeing their flight was waiting to greet them, along with a customs official to check their passports and welcome them back.
"Was the trip business or pleasure?" the customs official asked them,